Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. But here's a story from Canada that's probably a foreshadowing of things to come here in the lower 48. This was sent to me by a friend. I got this today. Its date is September 17th. The dateline is Calgary. I believe that the paper is the Calgary Herald. RCMP, that's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Dudley Do-Right's outfit, in other words, have laid five charges against a Calgary man related to the operation of a website highly critical of Calgary police officers. In a news conference Friday morning, RCMP announced the charges against John Kelly, 53, of Calgary. Kelly's website accused officers of perjury, corruption, and destroying evidence, RCMP said. Police deny the charges, saying they injure the reputation of Calgary police officers and interfere with an ongoing homicide investigation. Parenthetically, I don't think that the standard of libel in Canada is the absence of malice standard that prevails here in the United States. But when you're talking about a public official, for the most part, if I'm not mistaken, once again, I'll have to do some research into this, but I've looked into this somewhat because I've come across cases similar to this before, but never quite so extravagantly awful as this. But if I'm not mistaken, if you're dealing with a public official, it's almost impossible for a public official to frame a libel accusation against a private citizen. And I think that same policy would obtain with respect to law enforcement officials, prosecutors, and people of that sort. I'm certainly hoping that's the case because Pro Libertate, the blog, which, by the way, is available at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, routinely traffics in documented and factual accusations and demonstrations of corruption by police, prosecutors, judges, political officials, whether appointed or elected, etc. In this country right now, it's a matter of some controversy as to whether police have the authority, as opposed to the power, power and authority not being the same thing, whether police have the authority to arrest a citizen for using a cell phone camera or other digital device to photograph or to take video footage of police involved in various functions. There are many places, Massachusetts among them, I believe Pennsylvania is another, where police have been trained, no doubt, by their handlers and police unions to file wiretapping charges against anybody who uses a cell phone camera, assuming, of course, that the cell phone camera is making an audio recording, because otherwise it wouldn't be wiretapping. It'd be surveillance, but it wouldn't be wiretapping. The principle of law should be the following. Somebody who was wearing the insignia of government authority, or somebody who was carrying credentials denoting some form of public authority, at the moment that he assumes those credentials in whatever form, has sacrificed the presumption of privacy. You are now a public actor. You are publicly accountable in everything that you do. You are required to submit to video or audio documentation. And in your capacity as a public servant, you do not have the same assumptions of privacy with respect to libel, slander, and other defamation. If your actions are questionable, people who draw questions on the basis of the available facts regarding your integrity are not defaming you. They're holding you accountable. We'll talk a little bit more about this anon. We have a caller. Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts is with us. I just mentioned the Bay State. Jeff, how are you doing?
Oh, hey, I'm doing just fine. Well, you know what's on my mind is this, the police and Obama. Think of this picture. Now, remember, police are used as a revenue-generating service. And I always talk about third world countries. Don't have to go over that again. Now here's what's in my mind, which is Obama's on a stage, and you have the workers in the audience, all the people that Obama is drumming up in the great class warfare, SEIU, all the unions, you know, the usual suspects, the homosexuals, the a lot of the Muslims, and you know, the blacks, Hispanics, and so forth. You know, all the usual suspects. They stirring up in the communist,
the glorious mosaic.
Yes, diversity. You see, now with that you have the producers. Those are the business owners, the fat Wall Street people. The bourgeoisie class, and as they come up on stage one by one at gunpoint, Obama takes out the wallet of the producers and throws the money to the workers, and the workers jump up and grab the money, and then strips down the producers to their bare underwear, and then if they should complain, then they get tasered and taken off to a gulag somewhere. That is the police. In the future, in a nutshell,
the present.
Yes, but it'll be worse in the future because you get that 4:30 knock at the door. You have been a naughty boy, Will Grigg. You have been complaining too much. You are a traitor. You go to the gulag, comrade, Mr. Grigg, and comrade Jeff from Chelsea. No more complaints. We've been hearing about you. Time to shut down the internet.
You're a wrecker.
Yes.
Yeah, what Stalin used to call the wreckers.
Oh, wow.
People who talked down the Soviet economy and the Soviet accomplishments.
Terrorists.
It was actually, in the Brezhnev era, it was considered a form of clinical psychological disturbance to object to the accomplishments of Soviet socialism, because only somebody who is congenitally deranged would fail to see the majesty and grandeur of Soviet socialism in action. I can see us trending in the same direction.
Exactly. And that's why I'm kind of being a little lighthearted about this. Yahoo, which means drugs, lots of drugs, to get rid of that Yahoo fever and the Yippie syndrome. That way there I can say that 2 plus 2 equals 5 instead of 2 plus 2 equals 4 and be a good little honeybee in the hive. And you know what? There are some things I'm going through firsthand that I cannot share in the air at this time. I share in little leaks and drabs, but basically, it's personal stuff that, I can see the communism definitely coming to this country and tightening its noose around all of our necks. And it's divide and conquer, and that's what's at the end of the day, where everything will be government jobs. You're either with the government or you're not with the government. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. The terrorists are the right-wing people, Muslims,
yeah,
and whomever we choose. On that note, Will, I thank you for having me on the broadcast, and do have a good one.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a great Sunday tomorrow. Look, it's interesting to me, a couple of weeks ago we heard and read that the government of Cuba is going to be purging 500,000 taxpayer-fed drones from its payroll. A couple of days ago, I think the figure was leaked that it may be as much as 1 million. They're actually getting rid of government employees. Raul Castro has taken over from Fidel, has said that Cuba will no longer be the only country where you can live without working. Here in the United States, we're going in exactly the opposite direction. The government ruling us is embracing that which Castro's Cuba is at long last rejecting. Think about that for a second. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. Just before our last caller, I was talking about this episode unfolding in Canada involving a man by the name of John Kelly, who runs a website that is very critical of the Calgary police. Kelly was arrested Thursday and at his home. Another typo here, misspelling. It's not enough merely to trust the computer to spell check. You have to go back and personally eyeball everything you've written and get somebody else to do it for you, because as I've found as a blogger, as I pick through things after I have written and published them, a writer makes a very poor editor of his own material. You tend to develop a quality that horse trainers call barn blindness. If you're training a horse, you become enamored of that equine, and you tend not to see the faults, the flaws, etc. You get that way with your own riding, and that's why it's always a good idea to have an editor who actually goes through and with his or her own set of eyeballs and his or her own brain does the actual copy editing. Don't trust a computer. There's a typo here in this story which illustrates that principle. Kelly was arrested Thursday at his home. Let's see here. They give an address I'm not going to share with you. His home was also searched following an investigation that began in March 2010. He was to appear in Calgary Provincial Court on the charges Friday morning. RCMP Superintendent Randy McGinnis said the charges are very rare. In my 29 years, I've never heard of an individual being charged under the criminal code for libel, defamation of character, McGinnis said during the news conference. The website in question is still running, but RCMP can ask the New York-based internet provider to take it down. This is interesting. This reminds me a little bit of a case just a week or so ago in which a young man from London was arrested by Scotland Yard at the request of the FBI because this man had written a letter to Barack Obama saying something derogatory to Barack Obama that was not a threat. I don't think that the President of the United States should have any more or any less protection against threats than any other human being. I don't really care what his function or office would be in the government ruling us. No human being, of course, should be the subject of threats. And it makes no difference if you are the most powerful mammal on the planet or if you're somebody who's simply an ignominious supposed nobody living in a nondescript town in some not particularly significant part of the country. You're a human being, and the human being in the Oval is no more, no less than a human being, and no more or less of a human being than any of the rest of us. But this guy in London was arrested by Scotland Yard at the request of the FBI on the basis of something he had written to Barack Obama that wasn't a threat. Now, you've got a situation where this guy in Calgary, who publishes a blog critical of the local police, has been arrested by the RCMP, which apparently has enough juice with the internet-based or the New York-based internet service provider to get that ISP to take down the guy's blog. What makes Kelly's site libelous, said McGinnis, allegedly is the word missing from that clause, are the false allegations made against two city homicide investigators. It's the extent that he's gone to target and go after the members. There's information that he specifically attacked the moral integrity of the members, not just on one occasion, but on several occasions. Are the charges true? If they're not demonstrably true, are they a justifiable assertion based on what is known in the public record? Under the standard of law here in the United States, those would be the chief questions. If you're dealing with somebody who's a private individual, somebody who's a public figure, has a higher standard of libel. That's one of the reasons, by the way, why people who are of international stature often file libel actions in Great Britain, where the burden of proof is usually placed on the defendant rather than on the plaintiff, and in which actual malice does not have to be demonstrated. And in that venue, actual truth is not a perfect defense against libel. It almost always is a satisfactory defense against libel, defamation, or slander here in the United States. That, of course, is the operative principle here, or it should be. Charges include four counts of publishing libelous statements on the internet against specific police officers between November 2009 and September 4, 2010. A fifth charge accuses Kelly of obstructing a police officer from his duties between June 2008 and February 18, 2010. Because the individuals allegedly targeted are Calgary police officers, the investigation was handled by the RCMP, working with a special prosecutor. The names of the officers weren't included in the RCMP's press release. Presumably, they're available on this guy's website. Here's a second story on the same subject. Investigated, this is filed before, the story was filed before the arrest, are expected to announce today criminal charges against a Calgary man accused of running a website that allegedly contains defamatory statements about members of the Calgary Police Service. By the way, defamation, strictly understood, is neither libelous nor slanderous. To defame means to take away from somebody's fame, somebody's name, notoriety, reputation, etc. If you are publishing something that is truthful but defamatory, that should not be considered a tort. As far as I'm concerned, it should never be a crime to defame anybody. That's another odd and unsettling difference between the law in Canada and here in the United States, is that very rare. I don't think there is, for the most part, anywhere in the United States, criminal defamation laws. I think there might be some odd places like Louisiana. If I'm not mistaken, Louisiana might be a different situation because that's a state in which the formative organic law was taken from the Code Napoleon rather than from the Anglo-American common law. That's one of the reasons why, for instance, you have parishes rather than counties in Louisiana. There are some other oddities in Louisiana state law that reflect its unfortunate parentage in that respect, because the Code Napoleon, as you would expect, given that it was the offspring, sort of the bastard offspring of that eruption of totalitarian violence called the French Revolution, the Code Napoleon tends to be more centralizing and tends to be more the offspring, if you're talking about French philosophers, more the offspring of Rousseau than Montesquieu. Which is to say, it focuses less on the rights of the individual and more on the prerogatives of the rulers. But I don't think, apart from a couple of oddball jurisdictions in this country, you're likely to find criminal defamation laws. And I don't think criminal defamation laws should exist. It's a tort offense. It's an injury that should not be subject to criminal sanction. Subject to civil remedy, but not to criminal sanction. Kelly, let's see, Calgarian John Kelly is the longtime operator of a website that alleges dozens of current and former Calgary police officers, including several top members, are involved in corruption. An opening statement on the site's main page reads, quote, "This website is authored solely by John Kelly, and all of the information has been placed on this site by John Kelly, and John Kelly stands by the complete contents of this site, and it forms part of the materials to be used in the complaints made against Calgary Police Service officers and others named on this site for wrongdoings and corrupt and criminal acts." Kelly did not respond to messages. Sources said he was in police custody. Although defamation is mostly prosecuted through civil lawsuits, it is also a criminal code offense. Quote, "A defamatory libel is a matter published without lawful justification or excuse that is likely to injure the reputation of any person by exposing him to hatred, contempt, or ridicule, or that is designed to insult that person according to the criminal code." That is a perfectly wretched and reprehensible formulation. If you'll notice, nowhere in that section of the Canadian Criminal Code, which might as well be spelled with three K's here, I suppose, is there any consideration of the truth, the reliability, the necessity of publishing matters that are injurious to the reputation of the individual. Just about any incumbent politician could use that as a way to shut down just about any kind of published criticism or satire. Now, this is coming to this country, and in a sense it already has, because campaign finance reform, the Incumbency Protection Act, is based on the same premises here, pursued by different means. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Back at you in a minute. About 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, as a matter of fact, I was wandering through the C concourse at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport en route to New York City to attend the Millennium Summit at the United Nations headquarters, which was not my favorite event and not my favorite place, hardly my favorite institution, and not my favorite way to spend about a week in July or August of the year 2000. The concourse was almost abandoned. It was late Saturday afternoon. I had about an hour to catch my connecting flight when, to my rather pleasant amazement, I came across George F. Will. Now, back when I was a teenager and I was reading the newspaper in Rexburg, Idaho, and reading Newsweek magazine, to form my opinions about current events. This would have been the late Carter era, the early Reagan era. George Will became a hero of mine. Part of it's because he looked like Father Mulcahy from MASH, I suppose, a bespectacled, rather sedate and reserved individual. And I also love the fact that his essays were literate without being pedantic, and they tended to be rather colorful without being insulting to the intelligence of the reader. He wasn't a storyteller, he was an analyst. So I read his columns twice a week in the Post Register out of Idaho Falls and twice a month in Newsweek, and then started to watch him on ABC's This Week program beginning in 1983 or so. I read every book that he put out, his collections of essays, and his slender and largely indigestible volume called Statecraft to Soulcraft, and I found myself at loggerheads with a lot of his philosophy. He's somebody who believes in an interventionist government. At least he did until recently. He tends now to be a little bit more, not necessarily libertarian, but libertarian-friendly in his outlook than he was 20 or 30 years ago, which is interesting because as he approaches 70, he'll turn 70 next year, he's becoming more skeptical about government power rather than more authoritarian in his outlook. That's somewhat counterintuitive, but I think it's a wholesale, or rather a healthy and welcome development. I remember it would have been 1983 or 1984, he published an essay called The Splendid Legacy of FDR. And he talked about the idea that FDR should be considered the conservative hero because he believed in an activist government that was necessary to bring about social cohesion in the country in order to carry out what Mr. Will at the time considered to be the highest and holiest of all functions of government, and that was an interventionist foreign policy, beating back dictators of various kinds. Of course, FDR's legacy includes building up the most murderous dictator in human history, Joseph Stalin. He was his servitor in mortality, and as I've said before, I think that after FDR took the handicapped access rail to hell, he ended up serving Joseph Stalin in eternity. That would certainly be condign punishment for what Mr. Roosevelt did. Well, on the evidence of a piece that George Will published a couple of days ago, apparently he's rethought The Splendid Legacy of FDR. I'll just read a couple of excerpts from this essay because I do think that they betoken a rather remarkable and entirely healthy shift in attitudes on the part of George F. Will. He's talking about the so-called National Recovery Administration, that's the bad NRA, symbolized by the Blue Eagle escutcheon, which disfigured many businesses at the time. The National Recovery Administration was in charge of enforcing government-mandated prices for various products and services. One person who ran afoul of the so-called Blue Eagle was a hapless Polish-born tailor by the name of Jacob Maged, who charged 35 cents for pressing a suit. Now, the government-mandated policy was 40 cents, and so he was guilty of undercutting the price. Now, bear in mind, this is enforcing Keynesian economics at gunpoint. Keynesian economics says that the way to recovery is to stimulate aggregate demand, and also, as a codicil to that idea, one of the things that has to be done is you have to keep prices up. A depression is falling prices. The best remedy is to keep prices up. So you had people plowing under crops and slaughtering hogs and throwing them away, and also you had bureaucrats who seemed to know everything, dictating such matters as a 40 cent per job price for pressing a man's suit. Now, Maged was arrested and put on trial for the supposed offense of competitive pricing. Soon there were more than 500 NRA codes covering the manufacture of products from lightning rods to dog leashes to women's corsets, writes George F. Will. Amity Shales, by the way, once again, there's a misspelling here. It says Schles, I believe it's Amity Shales. This is in the Washington Post. Do they have copy editors at the Washington Post? Anyhow, Amity Shales in The Forgotten Man or History of the New Deal, which, by the way, is a series of footnotes, in my opinion, to John T. Flynn's far superior work on FDR, which is the Roosevelt myth. Amity Shales reports that the NRA generated more paper than the entire legislative output of the federal government since 1789. Businesses were asked to display the Blue Eagle, an emblem signifying participation in the NRA. General Hugh Iron Pants Johnson, an admirer of Mussolini, as were, by the way, many other people in FDR's brain trust, who headed the NRA, declared, "May God have mercy on the man or group of men who attempt to trifle with this bird." Well, here's a bird for you, General Johnson. And all fairness, General Johnson, after the NRA was scotched by the Supreme Court, one of the few times the Supreme Court's done something useful, General Johnson did become a leader in the America First movement. So give him credit for that. To continue, Magid trifled by his 5-cent violation of New Jersey's Taylor's Code, written in conjunction with the NRA. On April 20th, 1934, that was Hitler's birthday, by the way, he was fined $100, serious money when the average family income was about $1,500, and sentenced to 30 days in jail. The New York Times reported that Magid was only vaguely aware of the existence of a code. Not that such ignorance was forgivable. It is every citizen's duty to stay up late at night, if necessary, reading the fine print about the government's multiplying mandates. In court yesterday, the Times reported, he stood as if in a trance when sentence was pronounced. He hoped that it was a joke. Magid was an immigrant from Poland, which in the Cold War would become familiar with the concept of economic crimes and the use of criminal laws for the re-education of deviationists. Actually, his sentence was a judicial test. After Magid spent 3 days in jail, the judge canceled the rest of his sentence, remitted the fine, and, according to the Times, quote, gave him a little lecture on the importance of cooperation as opposed to individualism. This was in 1934. High-octane, unfiltered, Soviet-style collectivism. Enforced at gunpoint, in collaboration with judges who saw their duty as acting not only as arbiters of the law and servants of the law, but as tutors regarding the compelling necessity of surrendering your individuality in the interests of the collective. The judge emphasized that people, quote, should uphold the president and General Johnson in their struggle against, among other miscreants, price cutters. Then, like a feudal lord granting a dispensation to a serf, the judge promised to have Magid measure me for a new suit. What fine, suffocating condescension. Magid, suitably broken to the saddle of government, removed from his shop window the placard advertising 35-cent pressings and replaced it with a blue eagle. Magid, reported the Times, if not quite so ruggedly individualistic as formerly, was a free man once more. So that is freedom, embracing under coercion a government propaganda symbol. Freedom is another word for nothing left to choose, I guess. Hat tip to Radley Balko for that insight. Freedom is knowing the exact length of the chain by which you are connected to your master. Freedom is doing what the government requires of you under the threat of immediate individual extinction. That's how freedom is defined under the system that afflicts us. And it's been that way for over 70 years. Today, as 76 years ago, continues Mr. Will, economic recovery is much on the mind of the government, which is busy as a beaver, sending another $26 billion to public employees, proposing an additional $50 billion for infrastructure as it orchestrates recovery summer to an appropriate climax. But at least today's government is agnostic about the proper price for cleaning a suit. In 1937, FDR asked in his second inaugural address for unimagined power to enforce proper subordination of private interests to public authority. The biggest industrial collapse in American history occurred 8 years after the stock market crash of 1929 and nearly 5 years into the New Deal in 1937. Magid died here, that is, New Jersey, of cancer in 1939. He remains a cautionary example of the wages of sin understood by the progressives of his day as insubordination toward government that knows everything. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Well, it's good to see that George F. Will apparently has gotten over his infatuation with the execrable FDR. On the evidence of this column from this past week, he was in Jersey City and he wrote a very well-crafted, as is his wont, reflection on the trials, tribulations, and persecution of the hapless Joseph Magid, who was imprisoned at the age of 49 for the supposed crime of pressing a suit for 35 cents when the almighty, omnicompetent, and ultimately supremely benevolent government ordained that 40 cents was the proper price for performing that service. He was in jail for just a few days. In other words, this was an act of didactic state terrorism. It was terrorism as a tutorial, I suppose. And George F. Will once again finishes this column by writing the following. Magid died here of cancer on March 31st, 1939. He was 54. He remains a cautionary example of the wages of sin understood by the progressives of his day. I would insert in that section, and our day as well, as insubordination toward government that knows everything. The NRA lives on, sort of, in this Milton Friedman observation. Pick at random any three letters from the alphabet, put them in any order, and you will have an acronym designating a federal agency we can do without. You know what? I would include USA in that description because I believe that the current United States of America is a blight upon individual liberty. Looking at FDR's second inaugural address, which I was prompted to do after reading this column, I find myself reminded once again of what a full spectrum, oh boy, every epithet that occurred to me as a way of continuing that sentence is unsuitable for use on this program, but what a consummate reprobate FDR was. He really was inexcusable. He is probably, I don't know, it's difficult to say he's the worst thing that happened to the United States. It's hard to say he was worse than Lincoln. Somebody asked me once during the late and unlamented reign of Bill Clinton if Bill Clinton was the worst president in American history. I said, no, not by a long shot. Who's the worst? Well, Lincoln, obviously. Well, why do you say that? Well, 600,000 Americans died under Lincoln's reign. I'd say that's a pretty good definition of failure. Now, that sets the bar either awfully high or awfully low, depending upon which direction you want to go. If you want to talk about the body count, that's awfully high. If you want to talk about the desirability performance, the bar set off low. In any case, Lincoln remains, if you will, the not gold standard, but the pyrite standard, I guess. But FDR is a very close competitor. So was his cousin Teddy. So was Woodrow Wilson. So was George W. Bush. Barack Obama's got a shot at joining that reverse pantheon, I suppose. But reading this inaugural address, I find myself utterly sickened by this individual's bottomless self-adoration and by his apparent reflexive embrace of collectivism. When 4 years ago we met to inaugurate a president, this republic, single-minded in anxiety, stood in spirit here, begins FDR. By the way, this was in 1937, the year that the real collapse began. We dedicated ourselves to the fulfillment of a vision to speed the time when there would be for all the people that security and peace essential to the pursuit of happiness. We of the Republic pledged ourselves to drive from the temple of our ancient faith those who had profaned it, to end by action, tireless and unafraid, the stagnation and despair of that day. We did those first things first. Really, it reads like something Obama would recite off of his teleprompter in a lot of ways. It's the same gospel of self-deification by a president who is a figurehead for a regime that considers itself to be a holy artifact. To continue, our covenant with ourselves did not stop there. Instinctively, we recognized a deeper need, the need to find through government the instrument of our united purpose to solve for the individual the ever-rising problems of a complex civilization. Let me read that again, because that's the same gospel that Jean-Jacques Rousseau preached that led to the French Revolution, the idea of the common will being focused through the apparatus of government and incarnated in the Dear Leader, we recognized a deeper need to find through government the instrument of our united purpose to solve for the individual the ever-rising problems of a complex civilization. Repeated attempts at their solution without the aid of government had left us baffled and bewildered. Which, by the way, is bilge, piffle, rot, nonsense on stilts, because Herbert Hoover was an interventionist of exactly the same kind that FDR proved to be, and FDR in 1932 ran against Hoover from the right, contending correctly that Hoover was engaging in socialist intervention by propping up, through the use of so-called public funds, non-performing assets and enterprises. John Nance Gardner, who was a far better man than FDR, and if the assassin in Florida had better aim, he would have ended up being the president of the United States. Oh, alas for missed historical opportunities. Correctly identified Hoover as a socialist. So FDR knew this. He lied about it. He lied with the same autonomous reflex that, you know, in most of us is revealed in the heartbeat. Repeated attempts at their solution without the aid of government left us baffled and bewildered. For without that aid, we had been unable to create those moral controls over the services of science, which are necessary to make science a useful servant instead of a ruthless master of mankind. To this, we knew that we must find practical controls. To do this, we knew that we must find practical controls over blind economic forces and blindly selfish men. Oh, boy. People who indulge in rhetoric of that kind want us to assume that they are miraculously free of selfishness. Whatever it is that causes human selfishness, they're either immune to it or they have somehow isolated the antidote and selfishly, used it only on themselves. They're made of finer, purer stuff than the rest of us. In them, there exist none of the impulses toward greed or self-aggrandizement that characterize the lesser run of humanity, to which, of course, the rest of us belong. They're not blindly selfish. They're ennobled. They see further. They see better than the rest of us. To them, we can entrust these formidable powers that FDR is talking about. We of the Republic sense the truth that democratic government has innate capacity to protect its people against disasters once considered inevitable, to solve problems once considered unsolvable. Insoluble would have been a better word choice. We would not admit that we could not find a way to master economic epidemics, just as after centuries of fatalistic suffering, we had found a way to master epidemics of disease. We refused to leave the problems of our common welfare to be solved by the winds of chance and the hurricanes of disaster. That, of course, is a load of used food disguised as artistic metaphors. In this, we Americans were discovering no wholly new truth. We were writing a new chapter in our book of self-government. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Constitutional Convention that made us a nation. At that convention, our forefathers found the way. By the way, that's a lie as well. It was not a nation. It was a union of independent, constitutionally recognized republics. There's a more perfect quote-unquote union, which is a locution that has certain difficulties. But it was not a nation in the sense that Mr. Roosevelt referred to it. He's talking about the post-19th century, post-Lincolnian, post-Bismarckian, post-Leninist concept of nation. At that convention, our forefathers found the way out of the chaos which followed the Revolutionary War. They created a strong government with powers of united action sufficient then and now to solve problems utterly beyond individual or local solution. That, by the way, is not true either. Although too much has been done to sacralize the Constitution, one thing about it has to be pointed out emphatically at this point, and that is that the Constitution did not talk about unified or centralized effort. You had limited, specific, revocable powers invested in the government that was supposed to be the agent of the states. You did not have a centrally directed effort, unified or otherwise, to solve these problems. A century and a half ago, they established the federal government in order to promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to the American people. And I continue that thought, amending it by saying, they would do so by operating within the limited, constrained, and restricted powers granted to the central government in the text of the Constitution. Today, we invoke those same powers of government to achieve the same objectives. Then let me skip down a little bit because I'm running out of time. 4 years of new experience have not belied our historic instinct. They hold out the clear hope that government within communities, government within the separate states, and government of the United States can do the things the times require without yielding democracy, without yielding its democracy. Let's see here. We have begun to bring private autocratic powers into their proper subordination to the public's government. Fascinating. Something that's private can't be autocratic. Only government can be autocratic. But they almost must be subordinate to the government. Everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. That, of course, was Mussolini's formula. Then FDR goes on to talk about the new order of things. Boy, there's a phrase that has a certain resonance. Hey, look, it's been great to be with you this week. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. If you have the means and inclination, there's a PayPal button there. I sure appreciate some help. That's what's keeping my family afloat. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. I'll be back with you in a week. And until then, as always, Dum Spirito Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.